My guest today is Glenn Phillips, most often recognized as the former lead singer for the band Toad the Wet Sprocket. However, in the almost 20 years since Toad, Phillips has gone on to record numerous solo albums and collect a very loyal fan following. His latest album, Swallowed by the New, paints a very personal and intimate portrait of the artist dealing with some very emotional issues. Glenn Phillips, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, good to be here.
Give me just a little bit of background about the album, if you could.
I should also say, I'm once again with Toad. We put out a record about 4 years ago, and we do summer touring. So
it's sort of a every once in a while gets
together. It's on again, off again. We tend to do a summer tour. It's just not the full-time job anymore, which is really nice. So I'm the no longer former lead singer of? Anyway. The erstwhile lead singer of.
I like that.
But the new album came out of the disillusion of a 25-year marriage, or 23-year marriage, 25-year relationship. And I'd been trying really hard not to write a breakup album. And it's strange that the angle, how can I say, there's a lot of, on the one hand, I love some breakup albums. There's some beautiful songs about heartbreak. There's also a lot of songs about blame or kind of small thinking. And I was really determined to go through the experience. As hard as it was, I wanted to come out the other end, I don't know, with a whole heart and with respect for the, not, you know, with respect for the relationship. Dan Savage says sometimes that, you know, we have this weird idea that the only measure of a successful relationship is that one of you dies first. And if you can make it till one of you dies, like that's a win, and anything else is an unsuccessful relationship. And we had an incredibly successful relationship, and we're together since we were 18 and have three kids, you know, three phenomenal, you know, two, one in New York now, one in Boulder, about to graduate from university there. And we had a really successful relationship. And so how do you go? It's over, but it was successful.
Sure.
And I found in the process there were a lot of really bad role models, and I had to search a little harder to find good ones. And the literature that ended up really appealing to me ended up being much more about death and grief and transition. People like Stephen Jenkinson or David White's poems and talks about, you know, the inevitability of heartache, Pema Chodron and, you know, her books, Things Fall Apart, and Uncomfortable with Uncertainty, and all those upbeat titles. But Die Wise by Stephen Jenkinson, and Martine Prechtel's talk Grief and Praise, which led to the song Grief and Praise. So that was the literature that actually really spoke to me about what I was going through. And it wasn't so much about the he said, she said, or splitting the friends or any of that.
Sure. And the fact that there are children involved, I guess not necessarily children anymore, but kids involved, does that help keep you grounded in the high road so it doesn't become this sort of ugly breakup?
Yes and no. I have my own personal pride about it. is I know, you know, Laurel's, she's an absolutely amazing woman. Mm. I'm not an idiot. I married a great person. And she did too. And, you know, there weren't any mysteries to me about why it was over. I might have tried for another round, but I also think there was wisdom in calling it when it was called. And frankly, I can have a tendency to be pretty deluded and depressive. I do better when I have to get woken up by reality. Meaning my mind is capable of coming up with all kinds of scenarios that are terrible or seeing the worst in everything. But for some strange reason, when I'm confronted with actual discomfort, I get a lot more alert. I wake up a little. And I think she had a knowledge that for me to make my next step, I needed to be out of my comfort zone. Hmm. And within the realm of that home, you know, nothing that was asked of me, required of me, forced of me, but I became very small.
Small meaning petty or small?
Small meaning isolated and depressive and risk averse. And
you seem very self-actualized about that, very like grounded and aware of these.
For all the good it does me. I mean, and there's stages in all these things. I mean, even with depression I used to look at as an affliction. Hmm. And I feel like the next stage in looking at depression was objectivity. And instead of believing everything it's telling you, the next stage in depression is to be able to say, oh, wow, I'm telling myself these lies are all based on a true story, right? But I recognize what I'm going through and I know there's another end to it. I feel like that's stage two. Mm-hmm. And I've actually in the last year been able to see depression as a consequence of my loss. Like I had this first year where actually about a year after the divorce, I identified as a happy person for the first time. Like I started feeling like this is how normal people feel. I was feeling like optimistic in a way I don't know if I'd felt since my early 20s, and was really shocked. And I ended up going back into a depression, but for the first time really being able to notice my approach to it rather than having it be my baseline, right? Mm. And in the approach towards depression, I was able to see where kind of the loss of my voice, the loss of my integrity, the loss of my courage led to me being in situations where I felt like I had no choice and no voice again. But I could actually mark that path of the choices I'd made to take me along those lines where that became the inevitable conclusion. So it's a dance. I mean, you know, I think the ability to get deeply depressed doesn't leave you, but the skills increase. And to see it as a teacher and as something that's showing me actually when I'm out of alignment and when I've shut down, and to understand there's actually wisdom in this emergency system that rises in my mind and my body telling me something's wrong. And it's not necessarily that it's telling me the right things that are wrong, but it's telling me something's wrong. And I've developed a lot more respect for it recently. But back to the album. The album is about transition and about grieving properly and about showing up respectfully for the things you love that change.
Do you feel like being able to play music was a gift that you had that allowed you to help work through this?
Absolutely. And frankly, to do this record, this is the first record that I feel I've done with intent where part of what all these changes, and I had some other kind of spiritual changes in my life that led me to start thinking in kind of broader terms rather than like, it's just a few good songs. It's like, it's not going to reach everybody, but I wanted these songs to be medicine for people. And I felt, you know, loss, transition, change, these are things that are absolutely universal. And that I think our culture has some pretty haphazard tools to deal with. And I wanted to make some better tools for myself, for other people. I'm not saying there aren't amazing tools out there, but I think in general, we don't grieve very well.
In saying that, I think you may have answered one of my next questions, which was, because these songs are based in an uncomfortable situation, are they sometimes difficult to play live? But I guess if you're feeling that they can be universal and can be medicine for others, does that help you project this into a live performance?
Yeah, well, it gives purpose to it. I mean, whether it's about, it means they're not about me and this change and I'm going to sing you songs about, you know, how sad I am. It means like I made this album thinking about all the ways people lose their homes, right? And for me, this album goes out like the people who are coming in from Syria. I feel like, you know, there's leaving Old Town, there's these romantic things, but loss of home, however it happens economically. I mean, it happens, you know, so often. Most of America is one major illness away from losing everything they have, if they even have anything to lose. And that type of insecurity, you think of in kind of any other advanced democracy, you're not as at risk from that. And even in intact societies, if you're in Mexico, like the depth of family, the depth of community is such that to be truly left out is rarer. Like that sense of absolute, like we could have nothing, like so many people are so disconnected. And we don't necessarily foster those deep connections and understanding the importance of building those. So, I mean, a song like Grief and Praise, which works just as well for the death of a loved one as it does for a change in marital status or a change in a familial thing. And that I wanted once again to deal with stuff that was less about breakup and more about grief and gratitude. That's the thing about grief, is gratitude is such a huge component of it, right? That concept of grief and praise, Martin Pretel has this beautiful speech where he talks about how in the Mayan language, grief and praise are the same word. And they're both the outward expression of love in the face of inevitable loss. So grief is praising what you love and have lost. Praise is grieving what you love and will lose. And that idea that to fully grieve is an act of deep love. It's an act of respect. It's an act of humbling yourself to what you care about. And the fact that it does eventually all go away, right?
It's an acknowledgement of the impermanence of
everything. Yeah. And so for me, that's the center of the album, the center of all these songs, is respect for that. That happens in so many ways. That even happens, you know, David White talks about, we have this feeling that it's possible to fall in love without deep heartache. You know, it's like this weirdest lie that we repeatedly tell each other. And, you know, that even our kids, all they have to do is grow up happy and healthy, and they break our hearts, right?
Right.
They leave, they go away, they have these other lives. And so it's about things that come out of change, but we have this idea that change is injurious in some way. And it felt injurious, I must say, for the first year, but I was also very determined to go, okay, this isn't the end of me. This is not, if it's not injury, if it's just transition, which can be hugely painful, right? The most painful part of birth is transition. But at the end of that, it's a growth, it's change. That's neither good nor bad. It just is. And you can move into that well, or you can decide to be aggrieved. You know, there's a, I forget who it was that pointed this out to me, talking about rock climbers and mathematicians have this great thing in common, is they both love a good problem. You know, the rest of us, there's this idea that when you say the word problem, that implies that something is wrong. Mm-hmm. And if you're a rock climber, it's like a problem is just a bunch of handholds you got to figure out. Same if you're a mathematician, a problem is something magnificent to dive into and ask better questions about.
There is a solution, you just need to discover it.
Yeah, and it's not even that there's a solution necessarily. A problem is an opportunity to explore.
I want to talk briefly about the album itself and the sound. There's a lot of, I want to use the word austerity to the sound. It's just a very simple approaches, very clean sort of production of how you're presenting these themes. How much of it is a conscious decision to let, say, the words speak for themselves, or what was the mindset in the creation of the album?
The mindset, it was the song and the vocal were foremost, and everything should support that. Nothing should get in the way. And working with Paul Bryan produced it. I think we met each other really well on the aesthetic. I'd been wanting to make an album like this for a long time. And I feel like in the singer-songwriter kind of rootsy mode, this is the kind of record that I had been wanting to make, and found myself having difficulty finding, I don't know, the right situation in which to do it. So we wanted it to feel non-artificial. You know, things aren't doubled. It's a two guitar, bass, drums, keyboard band, and right. It's all possible to play live, and very simple, some beautiful quartet arrangements.
And the musicians that you chose to have on the album, were these predominantly folks that you knew and were familiar with?
Well, I known Paul from Largo. He actually was sitting in for Sebastian Steinberg with Watkins Family Hour at this club Largo in Los Angeles. So playing with Sean and Sarah, Ben Montench, Greg Lease, that group. And I'd met him a little bit before through just LA world. And he heard, I think I played Grief and Praise and the Easy Ones. And he came up after the show and said, I'd like to produce a record for you. So I called him back and we made it happen. And he also plays with Michelle Indeghiacello, which mm-hmm. he describes as like the most humiliating bass gig in the world, because basically she's better. He will just say, it's like, if you're a bass player, Michelle Indeghiacello is probably better than you. Mm-hmm. He's a great bass player. But so he plays bass with Michelle. And so Jevin Bruni, the keyboard player, Chris Bruce, they are guitar and keys with Michelle. Jay Bellarose is an old friend, and I've done a couple records with him, and I love his drumming. And Paul had been wanting to do an album where he could bring in Jay and work with him. And Ruby Amanfu is an old friend, and she's one of my favorite singers. Amber Rubarth is on tour with me right now. She co-wrote the song she sang on. And then my daughter Freya sang on The Easy Ones. She was 13 at the time. And she has this, like, this remarkably kind voice. She's also a remarkably kind person. So,
well, there's 11 tracks on the album, and there's a very strong continuity between mm-hmm. each, you know, among each of the pieces. But then, going back to this idea of change, the 10th track, Held Up, I feel like in listening to it, it takes a diversion. It turns into this almost like a Texas Chain Gang kind of sound to it.
Yeah, and that one came up. A lot of the songs on this album, titles from this guy, Matt the Electrician, who's a singer-songwriter out of Austin, Texas. And he does a thing, it's based on, Bob Schneider invented it, it's The Game, where basically every week Matt sends out a song title. So Wednesday evening, he sends out a song title, and there's like 18 of us on a mailing list, and everybody writes a song and turns it in the next Wednesday, and then we get a new title. And I had been trying not to write breakup songs. I'm like, I'm going to write a happy, danceable record. and then the titles I was getting were Reconstructing the Diary, My Criminal Career, Leaving Old Town. And I started writing those songs because of those titles. I knew what those titles were, and that kind of cracked the lid for me. But Held Up was another one of those titles. And it is a little break. It's my kind of version of a spiritual, and I've sometimes described myself as an atheist. I've been getting more and more used to the idea of the word God, because I like the idea of something to say thank you to. And I don't care if it exists or not. Like, I don't need anything from it except to thank, and that's my relationship with God. And there are these ideas of heaven or hell or the afterlife, and I have no idea what happens after we die, but I'm pretty sure if there's... For me, I think we go together or we don't go. And that's kind of the basis of the song. It's like heaven is helping each other out. And if I look at sins are lack of gratitude, lack of expansion, lack of generosity, you know? And so, yeah, it's just my bit on that. It was a fun one to sing, though.
Well, lastly, I want to ask you about touring, because touring has been almost a constant in your life for, what, the last 20
years?
Okay. Do you ever get tired of traveling?
I'm getting tired of traveling. Yeah. It's been a strange year. I mean, I fell in love again. I moved to Nashville with my girlfriend and was going back and forth between there and then a week a month in Santa Barbara to be with my youngest daughter, and then touring the rest of the time. And I realized I wasn't giving enough time to anybody, and I had no time for myself. So I moved back to California and left the relationship, and just realized in my limited time, I've never been solo. I met my wife when I was 18, and so the idea of home, I mean, I'm learning things about myself, like how I nest. You know, I've been living in a place that's like shared house with some friends, and it's a family. And on the one hand, that, you know, they're very inviting and good. But just going in and making some food for myself or some other people, like having my own kitchen, I realize I nest by cooking. I like cooking for people, I like making food for people. And it's like, okay, I kind of need a place where I have more kitchen access. And, you know, it's things like that that are just finding my own preferences, finding what makes home for me. And so it's odd being back in a situation where I moved out of Nashville, moved back to California. I was there for a week, then I'm gone for a month and a half. And I come back for a week, and then I'm gone for 2 weeks. And then, it's like, it's hilarious how much I'm going to be gone this year. And I have a work possibility that might take me 4 months of solid traveling for the last quarter, and I'm already feeling exhausted about it. I need to find a balance at some point. I mean, there's 2 more years hovering around Santa Barbara while my daughter is there, but I can't afford to live in Santa Barbara. So I don't know where I'm going to end up. I can get either really excited about it or incredibly, like, devastatingly frightened and depressed about it. I've been lucky enough to make a living by being on the road, but at this point, as things get smaller, I basically have to be gone half the time. So I need to risk staying home long enough to figure out what I can do. I mean, it's odd. I'm not a dumb person, but I have no marketable developed skills aside from playing songs in front of people. So
that's gotten you this far, though. So it's
okay. Well, it's gotten me this far, but I have friends who were the bass player in a band or whatever, and they're like, I can't go out solo acoustic. And they've developed other wonderful skills. Once again, you develop them when you need to, right?
Right.
And since I've always been able to tour, I've never developed those other skills. So at some point, I actually have to make the decision to slow down and decide where I live. And once again, that's a new thing. I used to kind of know, oh, I'll tour less someday, but I knew where my home was. And now I have no idea. And so I'll slow down soon. And that's kind of what my eye's on. It's like, what's my home? Where do I land after this? And what do I want to do when I grow up? So that I can tour like a quarter of the time? Because that sounds amazing.
Yeah.
But half the time is a lot. Someday, yeah, I'd like to be home long enough to like take a course at a college or have a garden for a whole season.
Well, it's been great having you here.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time to meet with us today.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure.
My guest has been Glenn Phillips. His latest album, Swallowed by the New, is now available online and at a music store near you. For links to more information about the album and the artist, please visit wvxu.org/aroundcincinnati. I'm Jim Nolan.